Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 57. We're recording this on February 15th of 2019, the podcast where we geek out about everything in the photo industry that is technical, that we can get under the hood of, that we can offer input analysis or just our opinions on. I'm your primary host, Don Komarechka, and we always have a guest on this show. With me today is my favorite guest. Partly because he kind of lives three lives. He is, he's a radio personality, at least on the weekends at KCAL Rocks. He is an IT professional, so he's got a good voice, he's got a technical mind, and he's also a concert photographer, so he understands the ins and outs of photography. So Steve Brazel is back on the show. Steve, what have you been up to lately?
Just got back from the wonderful weather in New Jersey.
Oh, New Jersey. Yeah. My condolences.
You know, it's one of the states I'd never been to, and I'd lived in Michigan for years, so I understand living in snow and everything, and the weather wasn't horrible. People were great, but it's the weirdest thing. No matter where you want to go, if you get in your car to drive somewhere, it's 25 minutes.
Well, that's true. It's not very densely populated. I mean, I shouldn't say anything bad against New Jersey, but you were there at a time where the weather in all parts of this side of the continent, so long as you're, you know, a little bit further north, has been bad. I've had to take the snowblower out twice this past week, and I think that's a chore that you might have never experienced in your life. Or if you were in Michigan, then you might.
Yeah, in Detroit, we used to. But what was really neat was, I mean, in all seriousness, I was there to help a friend with a concert photography workshop, and they really take care of it. I mean, it would snow overnight, and the next day, roads were plowed, salted. Everything was really well taken care of. There was no problem getting anywhere. It was really well done, and the people that came to the workshop were fantastic.
Awesome. That's great to hear. Who are you doing the workshop with?
A friend of mine is a well-known tour photographer by the name of Adam L. Macias, and he has started workshops that he's doing around. He asked me to help him with his one in San Diego, where he's from. And then within a month, set one up in New Jersey. And now he has one in the works for Chicago. It's at musicphotographyworkshops.com. And my pick of the week is related to something that happened at this workshop, actually.
Oh, very cool. So looking forward to getting to that at the end of the show. But we got a lot to get to before then. It has been one of the busiest, unexpectedly busy news weeks for stuff that we would like to cover on this show. So let's dive into it. The first story is this one kind of surprised me. I mean, I knew a new body was coming from Canon in the mirrorless world, the full frame mirrorless in the EOS R system. But I was expecting it to be a step up from the EOS R and not an entry level product. So here we have an article from DP Review, but again, everybody's covering this stuff, that the Canon EOS RP is smaller than a Rebel T7i and will cost $1,300. So one of the reasons why I was thinking of a higher end camera was because Canon did not have in-body image stabilization, which a lot of their competition had. There was some notable features that were missing that I might have expected on a higher end body. And then they hit the entry level market, which really shows that Canon is, I mean, I knew they were all in, but they are trying to pull in everybody from the ground level up, even if the pros aren't going to jump over yet. Because, and this actually makes a lot of sense, the pros are the least likely to change systems. It's the beginners that are likely to jump on board if the price is right. So, Steve, I know you've had a chance to mull over the specs and the details here. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, I mean, not clearly. Their thought process could be, let's get them while they're young type thing, right? Let's get the families, the kids growing up, to understand the mirrorless systems that we're putting out and come out with this more entry-level system. Is it the right move? Again, when they came out with the R, you and I had long discussions on this, that it was a beautiful camera in many, many ways, and yet sorely lacking in many, many ways when compared with the competition that was already out there. And my thought process has always been that Canon needed to come out at some point soon and establish themselves in the pro level end. My thinking for that is, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, my thinking is really how you establish yourself with the pros usually trickles down to consumer.
Yeah.
Consumer gear rarely trickles up to pros. So they need to get something out there that the pros use, that people see people using at weddings or wherever, so that the consumers will move that way. And in my opinion, they went the wrong way. This is a good move camera-wise at a point. I think they needed to come out with the other one first.
Yeah. Well, but to be fair, though, Canon has put, they use their not quite flagship gear for testbed technology. So dual pixel autofocus did not debut on a 1D series body,
true,
for example. True. And so there's a lot of the under the hood technology that, you know, you'll have there.
And their video stuff, by the way, debuted in the 5 series.
Exactly. And I think that just was the product cycle as it was churning. It just happened, yeah, to be that way. But, you know, this has the Digic 8 processor. But a lesser camera would have, like, say, the Digic 9. And then that would be released as a second product on a 1D class body that uses two of them traditionally instead of just the one. So they at least make sure they're not going to make mistakes with the new technology that they're putting into it, but they don't roll that tech into their entry level solutions. Except actually, in this case, there is a few of them. We're going to get to that, but let's talk.
But let me interject something here, because you said something that's really interesting, and that is, you know, the mistake type thing. However, you don't want to make a mistake on your first pro level body.
Yeah,
but you're going to have a larger user base in a consumer level body, and if you make mistakes there, that will resonate because pros will fear some of your pro gear. But as we move on, all that said, this is clearly a consumer body. This is not a pro level camera. And so just anybody that's out there judging this camera, judge it as that. Don't compare it with these pro level bodies and say Canon messed up here or did this. This is aimed at consumers who have different wish lists.
Exactly. Now, it's also a very small camera. I don't really think that the difference is going to be huge for a lot of people, but it's smaller than their Rebels and it's a full frame sensor. And so there could be a valuable selling point there. Well, it maintains roughly the same feature set as the R in terms of resolution, in terms of capabilities. It'll shoot 4K video at 24 frames per second.
But not
30. No, but okay. The end consumer that is going to purchase a camera, if you're not into high-end video production, if it'll do 4K video, it'll do the best 4K video that you'll care about.
Well, except I would argue that for this reason. If you're a consumer that's been shooting 4K video on your iPhone, for example, you're most likely shooting it more of a video format, not a film format, which is 24.
True.
You know, 24:9:7. And so if they were going to pick one frame rate to go with on a consumer body, my argument would have been that they should have gone towards the 30 end, not the 24.
Well,
end.
Maybe they're crippling it so that people would go for the higher end camera for the different features, or maybe they were, it's arguably it's the same processor inside. So I'm not sure exactly where the,
why do you think they did
soft?
Because you're going to have a frame mismatch if you try combining your iPhone frames with your iPhone footage. Well,
true. But I mean, at the same time, I just had a production house in Europe ask me to shoot them some very high quality 422 10-bit footage in 50p. And so, I mean, I can shoot that, but none of the stuff I have is that because I've never had that requested of me before. There's mismatches all over the place, right? There's so many formats.
True.
And so you just kind of have to work, but it's got an option for it. It's the same ISO range, although, of course, we don't know exactly what the quality is if you compare apples to apples.
Do you think it's the same sensor?
I think...
That's what my question was.
I don't know, because it would make a lot of financial sense for them to have the same sensor in both cameras, because they don't have to engineer two separate products, which would take a lot more money.
At the same time, doing a cheaper sensor would explain the almost $1,000 price.
Right, but designing a cheaper sensor would cost a lot more money, right? Regardless of if it's a higher end or lower end sensor, the research and development costs, because Canon still makes their own sensors, they're not buying them from a third party like Sony, then there would be a significant increase in cost rather than just spitting out more of the same one and putting it in this body. What I found really interesting with this particular camera is not only the price point. I mean, it's appreciable, you know, it's you're going to get a full frame modern camera. But they added a feature in this. I don't know if they've put it in any other cameras. I haven't been looking at the spec lists for all of the Rebels. But it, for the first time I've seen it on a Canon body, includes an intervalometer. Even the EOS R does not have an intervalometer. Every other camera that I have used from so many other manufacturers have had the built-in time-lapse feature. And now we are finally seeing that. Thank you, Canon, for joining last decade.
Well, do you think, though, again, I keep coming back to one thing. This is clearly a consumer camera. Now, on the spec end, it's really close to the R. And for the price difference with the R, that's insane, right? The R is $2,200 or whatever, and the body on this is $1,299. So if they call it $1,300 US. With a 24 to 105 F4, it's $2,400. So you can get this with a lens for the price of the R. You're talking 26 versus 30 megapixels. Same processor. They both have dual pixel AF. The focus points are close enough that no one cares, right? I mean, the R's got 5,600 something focus points, whereas this one's got 4,700 focus points. 47,
you know what? 4,700.
No one cares.
I think
that
is really where I draw the line.
Yeah, exactly. And even on the video stuff I mentioned, where it's doing 4K at 24p instead of 30p. Again, most people aren't going to, you know, and people are going to complain. It only does 1080 at 60p, not 120. The average consumer isn't going to care about any of that. So my question to you is, will an average consumer use this cool new feature that they added with an intervalometer?
No, absolutely not. So
Not a chance. Nobody knows how to do a time.
And it makes me wonder why that they throw features like that onto cameras like this. Now, if I dive more into the specs and how they shoot 4K, they actually crop in a little bit differently on the 4K, which might make it seem like it is a different sensor that they're using within that. So,
speaking of which, while you're on that, I tried to do a bunch of research on this last night. The RP, mm-hmm. the new body, the consumer body, I'll call it. Any idea what the P stands for?
I have
for,
no
by
idea.
Way?
It's very cryptic. What
sounds pro?
What
and
does
it's
the
not.
R stand for? Even
yeah,
know, racing.
But the RP appears to be a 1.6 crop on 4K video.
Yeah.
Everything I found said the R is
1.74, I think.
But I found a couple that said 1.6.
No, the number that I saw was down to two decimal points, which was 1.74. So
they are a different
video. It's a different video crop. And so that's, I mean, unusual, I guess. But
it could be throw between the lens and the sensor.
Well, I mean, in one scenario, you could say if you've got a 30 megapixel sensor and you're only using the center 26 megapixels on it, so it is the same sensor, just slightly modified, and it's not truly a full frame,
right.
You're losing a little bit on the outside edges, the delta between those two might make up for that crop factor difference when shooting 4K video. But that's just a shot in the dark. They could just be two entirely different sensors. We're speculating at this point. Right.
But they do have a video crop, which real video people will hate. Consumers aren't
exactly
going to care at all.
Now, the big difference between these two is frame rate, frames per second. So you've got on the EOS R, 9 frames per second. The RP is down to 5. And that's a deal breaker for some.
R is 8 frames per second.
Is it 8? Oh, that's right. Yep.
And it's 8, but it's only 5 if you do servo
AF. And I think Panasonic is doing the same thing with their new S-series cameras, where if you've got the autofocus on, the frames per second will go down. If you're not using that, then you'll be up to 9,
right.
Or whatever it happens to be.
And the RP does too, but it only drops one frame. It goes from 5 to 4. And again, that's one of those things, you know, for what I shoot, do I want 8 over 5 frames per second? Yes, but for the average consumer, 5 frames a second catches their kid.
Yeah, and I shot for years with the Canon 5D Mark II, and I got a ton of great shots with that at 3.9 frames per second. Now, more is better in some cases, but it's not going to break the sale deal here. You're not going to say, you know what, I was dead set on this camera, but we're a frame per second or two off from what I really want. I don't think, at least at this price point, it's as pivotal a feature. So here we have Canon kind of cannibalizing the R to some degree with this new RP to create more buzz on the lower end of the market. And I wish them luck. It just kind of seems like the opposite move from what I was predicting they would have done.
Yeah. And to me, it's the wrong direction, going down instead of up first. But I could very easily be wrong, because this, for a consumer, this is a lot of camera.
Oh, yeah.
For the price that they're given this thing, there's a couple of negatives to me, or a couple of things that could matter to consumers in the long run. Probably not. This thing does AF from minus 5 to 18. The R does minus 6. The shutter speed is going to be an interesting one. I don't think consumers will care that it maxes out at 1/4,000th instead of 1/8,000th.
The Rebel cameras have always maxed out at 1/4,000th of a second. Yeah.
At 1/4. Okay. So then they're not going to care about that. They both have Wi-Fi. But I talked to you in the green room, as it were, before. One of the things that's going to come back to haunt this thing is when we talk about the next story. And one of the areas that I did notice that's a big difference between what we're talking about here with the EOS RP from Canon is the battery is rated at roughly averaging about 250 shots. Its max rating is 270 shots. And the next story that we're going to talk about right. blows that away.
But before we get there too, though, I just have to state that the RF lenses aren't exactly cheap right now either. I mean, yes, you can get adapters for them, for some of the adapters that are available right now and use...
Three different adapters.
And you can use other older lenses on this camera to kind of bridge, you know, to start you into the RF system. But if you wanted to just dive wholly into this and get a couple of lenses and get a nice kit going, the discount on the camera body is going to become much more minor when you add in the cost of the glass. But we're talking price, right? So the price is a big concern, especially when you see what the competition is doing. So the next story, this one from...
Well, before you get into that, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about, too, because I'm curious if you saw this. And you're right about the glass, by the way. Like I say, the body is $1,300. It's another $1,000 to get the kit. And that's a discount getting the kit with a 24-105. Most consumers aren't used to spending almost the same amount of money on their lenses as their bodies. But here's the thing. The article made a note that the USB on this was USB 2. And when I saw that, I thought that makes absolutely no sense. That you're offloading full frame 26 megapixel images over USB. I went and looked in the Canon page, does say that it's USB 3.1 okay. Gen 1.
So that's, I mean, that would probably be a type A connector. Maybe it's a type C, or it wouldn't be type A because that's the big blocky one. But I would hope that they put a type C connector on all things.
Well, it could be a type A, but it's probably, yeah. I'm guessing, a type C.
Okay, so... Let's move on to this next one because it really casts a shadow over the first story.
Oh boy.
From Petapixel, Fujifilm has unveiled the X-T30, a light 4K camera for $899. So if you look through the specs on this camera, it matches almost perfectly to the EOS RP. It's a 26 megapixel camera, has a very similar ISO range. I mean, it's not identical, but for the
quad-core CPU.
But here's where things get really fun. If you're using the mechanical shutter, it's 8 frames per second. If you're using the electronic shutter, you can go up to 20 or 30 frames per second, depending if you've got a crop on it. So you've got a lot of different high-speed options.
And let's be clear, the crop is less. It's only 1.25. Yeah,
true, but it is a smaller sensor to begin with because it's APS-C as the native format for...
Correct.
For the camera sensor. But, you know, I'm living proof that a small camera can produce exceptional high quality imagery. I was shooting with the GX9 for over a year as my primary exclusive camera, and I've had a lot of sellable work from that. So whether it's Micro Four Thirds, APS-C, full frame, you can get a great image, a great quality sensor at any size. And that, you know, puts the ball into Fujifilm's court here to say if this is an equal product in terms of resolution and quality for those pixels, we've got to see what these images turn out to be at the end of the day. And I got to reserve that judgment until we have those nice sample charts that.
Okay, but what's your prediction?
That they'll.
You're thinking it's going to be a good picture.
I've got a feeling that it will be maybe that. The most astute pixel peepers in laboratory settings might be able to tell a difference, but for the people these cameras are targeted to, there will be no practical difference whatsoever in image quality. And so there you have it. You have an established system that has a very, very high quality sensor. It beats out the EOS RP on every level of the spec sheet, and it comes in $400 cheaper.
Yep, with cheaper glass.
Well, and of course,
so this body's $900, but you can get it with an image stabilized 15-45 variable aperture, but still for only right. $100
and it will do and it will do 4K video at 30 frames per second. And if you're doing HDMI out recording, so you can record to an external device, then it'll do 422 DCI 4K, which is the full 4,092, not the 3,800 and something that is the consumer. So you got the full cinema 4K experience with the 422 10-bit recording, which
Canon, by the way, the RP only does 8-bit. The R will do 10-bit over right. HDMI, but the RP will only do 8-bit. This will be do 10-bit.
So this is just eating Canon's lunch. I mean, every other feature is roughly comparable. You've got a 2.36 million dot electronic viewfinder. I'm not sure if they're using the same one in there, but it's the same million dot output. So, you know, you just look at all of this.
And remember what I said about the battery?
Oh, yes.
I made a point about that battery on the Canon for a reason. 250 shots was about the average on all the specs. The max number that I saw was 270. And the battery on this thing will do 380 shots.
That's
it's, I mean, they're even beating battery.
Yeah, of course. But the battery ratings are a bit of a misnomer. These are based on International Standards Organization specifications for time delay between shots, using flash with the LCD screens on. And there's some very strict criteria. If you're shooting rapid bursts, you'll get far more than 300 odd shots.
Well, but my point being, you're going to get more shots out of this body. It's about the same size body.
Beholden to the same standards to come up with those numbers. And so a higher number in any scenario means that, yes, you will get more shots out of it. It'll last longer.
One thing I want to point out that's also interesting here is it's phase detect AF over the entire frame, which was fascinating to me. But then let's just talk Fuji to Fuji now. So from the previous cameras that Fuji came out with, which was the X-T20.
That's the predecessor to it.
They've improved their low light from plus 0.5 EV to minus 3 EV.
Right.
So they've made big improvements.
I haven't looked at those specs specifically. Plus 0.5 to minus 3. Yeah, I heard you say plus 5, but plus point. That plus makes more sense. Yeah.
If I did say plus 5, I meant plus 0.5 to minus 3 EV is a large improvement.
Exactly. And, you know, you've got people that are going to be using this camera, even with a kit lens that does not have a very wide aperture on it, to do like family snaps, and autofocus needs to be improved without having a really fast lens on the camera.
Exactly. And think about, again, talking about eating Canon's lunch on this. You've got a body with what is considered to be often the standard kit lens, an 18 to 55, but this is an 18 to 55, 2.8 to 4. And with the body, you're talking $1,300, the entire price of the entire Canon body.
Right. But if you want just the most basic kit lens, the XC 15 to 45, that only adds $100 to the price tag. So you're still a dollar under a grand for a camera and a lens if you just want to get going.
An image stabilized lens. I mean, this is a lot of camera for less than a grand.
It is. And I just... Canon is... They're too big to make one mistake and call it quits. I mean, there's going to be new cameras from them coming out. They're already in the pipeline and we will see them at some point. I have no idea when, but it's not like this is the last camera that they'll ever produce, even if it doesn't do very well for it. But I don't think it will do very well for Canon. When the competition, especially if you're just leaving your existing system, you're a flapping mirror Canon or Nikon or Pentax shooter, and you want to jump into a mirrorless body, you're going to look at all options because brand loyalty really isn't what it used to be these days. And in that case, you know, if you're holding up both of these cameras in your hands, I would have to go to the Fuji between the two of them.
So here's the question, because to me, what Fuji did here was predictable, right? We all have seen we talked about the direction Canon was going. We've seen the higher end features that show up in the higher end bodies trickle down to consumer. The higher megapixels, the better processors, the better shutter speeds, the better low light performance. This was predictable. This was going to get down in low price. We understand that. And Canon clearly doesn't compete with this. My fear is Canon thinks they compete with this. Is Canon trying to compete for the same market as this body? And I would argue when they released a $1,300 body, this was the consumer they were going for. And they're going to get them because there's some people that won't buy Fuji. They're going to buy the Canon for whatever reason. But or, I'm sorry, I think they lost here.
You know what? Full frame cameras do have an advantage in certain cases, especially now when you're going to high megapixels, right? When you're getting 40 plus megapixels, a full frame camera really shows an advantage because each one of those pixels can be larger.
To a consumer?
Well, but to a consumer, there's
gotta keep those glasses on. This is mom at a soccer game.
Here's the thing though, is full frame is better as a blanket statement is what a lot of consumers think. And so that might, again, put audience back towards Canon. But from the technical reasons, it doesn't really have the advantage today where you can get a 20 megapixel micro four thirds, a 26 megapixel APS-C camera, a 40 to 50 megapixel full frame camera that's on the market right now. And they're all roughly comparable if you zoom in and check out the pixels. And I'm oversimplifying things to a great degree. But the size of the pixel then matters. So...
But you know, so does what you're shooting. And I look at what you shoot, for example, and what you're shooting with your Panasonics, which up until recently was not full frame.
Yep.
What Andy Iannotko shoots with his Micro Four Thirds, what Scott Bourne shoots. There are enough pros out there right now singing the praises of other sensor technologies that, yeah, there's still that thing in the mind of consumers that full frame is better. And to people like you and I that shoot, I wouldn't shoot anymore on not full frame.
Well, oh no, I would shoot Micro Four Thirds all the time when I'm traveling. I do not want to carry super heavy glass. There's certain reasons why you would go for a certain class of a product. And on the last episode or a couple episodes ago, we talked about the OMD EM1X from Olympus and all the craziness that they're putting into a very high quality Micro Four Thirds camera. So if we're talking, it is kind of apples to oranges here, but they're after the same audience. Fuji's got this one buttoned down. So good luck Canon to bring that market, but it's kind of like watching a train wreck there. You know, it's like it's about to happen and it's going to be moving really slowly and the cars are going to derail and you'll see things fall out of them and you know this is all going to happen. You can't stop it, but you can just sit and watch.
they threw a gauntlet down here, and it's no accident that the headlines that are coming out are not talking about the fact that this is a stills camera, a light 4K camera.
Yeah.
Right. They're attacking on multiple fronts. And there's a lot of Fuji fans out there even that are going to want this for travel.
And it's got a tactile feel to it. It's got a plus and minus exposure variance dial on the top. And it's got it's got dials and buttons and knobs and things that, for me as a photographer, I like. As a consumer that wants to just get it quickly without hunting through menus, that's fine. And they've also added an SR auto mode that is activated by a lever. Oh, I love levers on cameras that lets photographers select shooting settings from 58 different presets. So if you don't want to muck with all those details, you can move a lever.
It's kind of retro.
It's kind of retro. They say lever specifically. I'm not even seeing on the camera body where this lever is, but I can see it. It's next to the shutter speed option.
Can you tell? I didn't look. It looks like an articulating screen. Yes, it is an articulating screen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So anyhow, good on you, Fuji, for coming out with an awesome camera. And,
agreed.
Eat Canon's lunch. I was a Canon shooter for many years. And brand loyalty. I'm going to still be shooting with some Canon lenses. In fact, one of them is a pick of the week for me this week. But yeah, anybody that wants to buy a 1DX Mark II or a 1DX modified for full spectrum photography, I've got these two cameras up for sale right now.
Well, I may want your 1DX Mark II.
Because I'm getting out of the Canon ecosystem, but we'll talk after the show there, Steve.
Sounds good.
Right, let's go into the next one, which I'm glad I've got you on the show for this story.
Oh my God.
Because you are in the... let's preface this. What do you do in the IT world as part of your day job?
I'm an independent network consultant, so I consult small businesses on IT needs. I'm small enough that I do a lot of hands-on, but I also deal with companies where they have either a full in-house IT department or an IT service that does it, and I'm their second opinion, as it were, second voice. My background is I'm an old school MCSE, so I got my first Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer for the old people out there on Windows NT 3.5.1.
Oh, lovely. And I've had a long expired CCNA certification, but that's Cisco, not Microsoft in that case.
Right, right. But, same thing. And I looked at Cisco at the time. I just didn't do it.
Yeah. When you're consulting, and you don't have to name names, you don't need specific details here, but how many times do you encounter potential security risks? It could be lackluster passwords that are taped onto computer monitors, things that are not protected by passwords whatsoever, or they're the manufacturer default password on a router, things like, how much does that kind of come up?
Well, in my networks, never.
Well, but, you mean you make sure that they don't once you've established yourself.
There are certain things that are just, you know, to people who do it for a living or just you don't even think about it anymore. But in networks that I go into that I don't normally work on, it's everything that you mentioned above plus common passwords. So where they'll have five employees, but they don't want to pay the licensing fee for a what's called a CAL, a client access license for server. And so instead they'll use a single client access license for shipping, but they've got 10 shipping employees and they all share that login, which means if something goes wrong, if somebody does something insecure, it's more difficult to trace it back to a user. Mm-hmm. I have seen literally people tape passwords to their screen. I have seen people email passwords back and forth to each other, sharing them, which is one of my pet peeves.
Oh, well, because you
never tell another employee your password.
Well, and even if you do, I mean, email is plain text. Don't send anybody any password for any reason ever.
And the other thing is, it's one thing if you just send somebody an email out of nowhere that has nothing in it, but the subject is, how are you? And the in the body text is XYZ parentheses bracket 49 asterisk. No one knows what it's for. But I see people literally say, and I'm going to tip the article now, hey, John, here's my 500px password. You know, and then include the password. So if somebody did interrupt that email, they know exactly what it is.
Right. And so you spilled right into the story, which is reported on pretty much everywhere. I chose a link from The Verge because it was a more mainstream tech blog, not just photography, to show how widespread it is. Personal information of 14.8 million 500px users leaked in a security breach. And I'm just going to read from the article really quickly to set the stage here. Photo sharing website 500px says that personal information of 14.8 million of its users was impacted by a security breach that occurred in July of 2018. The site says that it's in the process of notifying all of its users and resetting their login credentials. So they reset everybody's password. They only discovered it this month. I can't remember the exact date.
They discovered it February. Most of the articles say February 8th, but I did see one oddly that said on or around February 11th.
Okay, so, but earlier this month, within the last week or so, this was discovered. So this is, it's a challenge for me on a number of fronts. The intrusion, the breach happened in July of last year. And there's a lot of technology that companies can use to make sure that their networks are safe and secure. I mean, you've got, what are they called? They're canaries that can sit on any network and they can appear to be anything, that are really juicy targets for hackers, but they aren't actually those things. It's a honeypot. It'll set off a silent alarm and let people know that somebody is in the network and there's an intrusion. People are poking around and close this right now. Clearly, they didn't have anything like that, or the hackers were extremely...
Well, and not to mention any, and I know that 500px has to be using fairly high-end perimeter hardware, for security. And many of those services, whether it be a Cisco or a SonicWall or a WatchGuard security device, many of those have built-in services for intrusion detection that look for pattern matching on different types of things that are coming from the outside in. Most of those would have triggered and notified somebody. Doesn't mean you can't get around them. You can get around any security, and maybe the person who came in was really, really good. But if you're checking logs, you would have seen people pulling.
You would have seen a massive amount of all of your users' data leaving your network.
Yes. Gigabytes of data being pulled out of your network to an IP address that you don't know. And it took them 7 months, 6-7 months, whatever, to catch it. And that to me is the story here.
Well, and especially because it was unpatched during that interim time. We knew that the initial breach happened in July. They aren't mentioning any subsequent ones, but I don't think that they published the number of users that they have on the service, Steve, but 14.8 million is a lot. That might be everybody.
That it probably, my guess is it probably is close to everybody. And then the other thing is that we need to say is, this stuff is not just hacked and they found out that they got hacked. This stuff is actually right now for sale for very, very little money. Like, I think it's $800 worth of Bitcoin or something. If you want to buy for the sites that are selling it, they have a bunch of sites that they got. The 500 PIX data set you can buy for like $800 worth of Bitcoin.
And the data set is first and last names, usernames, email addresses, password hashes. So not plain text passwords. They don't say exactly how they were hashing the passwords.
Actually, it is known how they were hashing the passwords.
Okay, well, I'll get back to that in a second. Okay. The location, city, state, and country, birth date, and gender. So if a password is poorly hashed, then with the growing computational power the world over, some of those hashing techniques, especially if you've got a poorly constructed password like monkey123, it's easy to figure out exactly by running it through whatever brute force algorithm to figure that out. But how did they hash?
So the old passwords from long, long ago, and I tried finding it again somewhere. I saw Dayton in my head. The date was something before 2012. But I can't find it again to confirm that. But any passwords that were generated prior to a particular date were MD5. MD5 is a known algorithm. It's easily brute forceable and hackable. It's somewhat trivial to somebody that knows what they're doing. So when they are resetting everybody's passwords, they're starting with the MD5 hashed passwords. So that's a good thing that they're starting with the most vulnerable passwords, right? The problem is, and I'm going to get into something on password hygiene in a second here. The rest of them, I think, were SHA-256. I'm not sure, but those are going to be harder for the person who got this to hack, but they've got all the time in the world. They've got a data set in front of them.
Right. So SHA-256 is one of the more prominent standards today, although there's other things that you can do to salt the hashes and to make them more
obfuscated. And these were salted too, I do believe.
Okay. So, and all of that means is we're adding layers of complexity onto the system. I don't want to make this a whole discussion about exactly what that technology is, but it's
actually though, since you mentioned that, let's just touch one thing though. When you are going to a site and you're doing your passwords, knowing that they are salted is an advantage. And basically what that means is if Don gives me a password of monkey123, I take that password of monkey123 and I add some other data to his password to make it more complex that he doesn't even know about, but also just ratchet it up a little bit.
Exactly. And so it's an extra level of protection. However, in terms of password hygiene, I have been in the last little while, again, there are standard things. Never use common words. You know, don't even think you're being fancy when you're substituting the letter I out for the number one. Or, you know, you're combining multiple words together because that can be easily figured out. And especially using the same password in multiple locations is a huge pet peeve of mine. I use to generate passwords is GRC, Gibson Research Corporation, has a wonderful password generator that will spit out lengthy random passwords that are truly random. And I just go there, they're automatically spit out on the website for me. And I use those as all of my passwords, especially on accounts like social media, where they're very brand important.
So are you using a password manager?
Right now I'm just using the one that's built into Firefox. But it is a password manager of sorts. I do want to move everything over to LastPass, which is much more secure.
Yeah, LastPass, I use 1Password. My two favorite are LastPass or 1Password. And if, for example, if you use Eero Wireless Networks, which has now been purchased by Amazon, the Eero Plus gives you access to 1Password. Both of those services or softwares will generate passwords for you. And part of the reason that I like password managers over using a built-in OS like Safari Keychain or a built-in browser password management is once you unlock your account, they are unlocked and just available to you to use. Whereas a password manager can automatically relock itself after whatever 5 minutes or 15 minutes, so that even though you're in your OS, your vault is locked.
Yeah, and what I like about LastPass, I haven't looked into 1Password, but I do know that they have absolutely no ability, even under threat of government action, they have no ability to access your passwords. There's no backdoor.
Correct.
There's no way for them to decode your data without your master password. And you don't give that to anybody. So if your computer's compromised or their databases, because like 500px is hacked, anybody can be hacked. It's happened to so many people. I wouldn't want of all places.
NSA's been hacked.
I wouldn't want of all people my password manager to be hacked, because that's the holy grail. And I'm sure that they've got a lot of people looking at them to try and make that happen, and it hasn't happened. So.
And let me correct something, because I just looked it up. 500px, it was 1.5 gigabytes of data. And they were both three different encryptions, MD5, SHA-512.
Oh, good.
Those are going to be really hard to hack. And then Bcrypt, hashed passwords.
Okay, so here's my problem with all of this, though, Steve. I saw reports online of people that had deleted their 500px accounts years ago that were getting notifications from 500px to reset their passwords, which means 500px did not delete their account, at least not in its entirety. And that data, that who knows what amount of data they retained. The images might not be there, but all of that leaked information in terms of your username and password and name and location and all of that stuff might not have been deleted, especially if they're getting these emails sent out, because clearly their email address was still on file.
See, and I'm going to challenge that a little bit. And the truth is, I don't know, right? You could be 100% that they deleted the account in the sense of they deleted the photos, but the account stayed dormant in their servers. That's one possibility, at which point the hackers got all of this information, even though you'd closed your account. There is another possibility, and that is that the emails are being stored in an email management system separately from or duplicated from the actual security data set. So it's entirely possible that when those users closed their accounts, the accounts were purged, were deleted, but the email addresses still exist for bulk emails.
Right. And I haven't actually reached out to anybody that had this exact scenario happen to see if they were able to reset the password on a deleted account, if that was even a possibility, which would be the test to figure that out one way or the other. But either way, it's unsettling.
Very unsettling. Now, there's one thing I want to point out. If you're a 500px user and you are one of their paid level as opposed to free level of accounts, don't panic about your credit card, because their credit cards are not stored on their servers.
Good, because I am. So I do credit pay card them a small amount of money. I'm not their full level, but I'm even questioning whether or not I'm going to continue, because they switched hands to China. They closed down their marketplace and they did some redesigns that were iffy. Now they've got this massive hack. And
then they did the resell thing, and then they ended up resending that back because it didn't work well. But here's the big picture for users. You know, I made the comment that passwords before a certain date were MD5 hashed, which means they never had the ability, if you'd never changed your password, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you had a random, difficult 16-character password that you set in 2012, it was hashed with MD5, it's hackable.
Yeah.
Right? Even though you thought you had a really good, strong password, it can be decrypted because MD5 was found to have weaknesses in them. And you never reset it, and they can't go re-encrypt your password. You have to do that by recreating it or regenerating it. So let this be the password hygiene lesson. This is why you periodically, for whatever reason, change your passwords, even if they're secure, because you don't know how they're being stored. And if that company upgrades their security infrastructure and upgrades their processes to store your data more securely, you need to take advantage of that by triggering the new sequences.
That's very good advice. And they're not going to go back and proactively upgrade your password security, because you have to reset your password in order to trigger that in any case. Maybe some people...
Because they can't read your password. Well,
exactly.
To do it.
Maybe some services would give you a little notice saying, hey, by the way, we've made some security improvements in our back end. If you were to choose a new password now, it would be stored more securely on our server. But I don't think any company's going to do that because it...
I've never seen a company do it, but it would be a neat thing.
It would kind of show weakness and growing out of a weakness that they previously had, and companies would rather just make that invisible to the end user. Although, as somebody that knows how this stuff works, I would rather see that.
So would I. And one thing I do want to touch on before we leave, if we have time, story... is just passwords in general, because I still think most people don't understand password hygiene. So let's just take a hypothetical here that you are like most people out there and you reuse your passwords. And you may think you're secure because you have three different passwords. And you have a password that you use for sites you don't care about. You have a password for sites where you shop. And then you have a password for work stuff, right? So you have three. You think you're really secure. Here's the problem with that. These are online. Target gets hacked. They're online. Home Depot gets hacked. They're online, right? Once I know your email and I know your password, all I have to go do is try that at Amazon, try that at iTunes. If it's your shopping password, then it's going to work at every shopping site. And one of the biggest things I hear from people is I say to them, make sure above all else that your email password is not used anywhere else on the planet. That your email, if you don't want to buy a password manager, which I think is wrong, if you're going to have a limited pool of passwords, make it so that your email password is singular and unique. And people go, why? It's just my email. Well, here's the deal. If I go to your bank and I say, let's pick a random bank. If I go to Union Bank and I know what your email address is, which is probably your username, and I type that in and I've got a pool of passwords that I think you may use, and I get into your bank, then I've got your money, right? Well, if I go to your bank and say, here's my email address, I forgot my password. They're going to email you a link to reset your password. And if I've got your email account, I own you.
Exactly. That's
hands down.
And there's even been cases where, and some social engineering has been involved, where I forget the guy's name, but he had everything hacked because his second factor authentication of his phone number, he actually called, that the hacker called in and got somebody at the phone company to change the phone number, change the account. And
it was SIM hacking.
It's something like that. So we are so vulnerable in so many ways is what I'm trying to say. And then when I see one of the photo sharing websites that I have been posting everything on for years to have my data in the hands of hackers, well, it raises another red flag. Maybe that's the final nail in the coffin for 500px for me. Maybe I'll finish off my Snowflake series at the end of this year and say goodbye to you. I do have an audience in the thousands there, but is it worth it when it's just continuing to degrade and deteriorate? And I think that unless they do something really good, it's always been steps down since 2012.
And if you go with a password manager, what I tell most people is, because most people, they aren't used to randomly generating passwords like you and I do, and they're afraid they're going to forget it and not be able to get in. So what I tell people is, for the vault, for the master password, pick something insane. You only have to remember one. Pick something crazy, right? But then inside LastPass or 1Password, they have things to tell you if your password has been pwned. They have things to tell you if you have weak passwords in your vault so that you can easily reset them. They have things to tell you if you've got duplicate passwords. I just went through all my passwords 3 days ago and reset all my passwords because I found some that were duplicates that were old and I reset all those. My wife is doing some of hers today, in fact. But when you switch to a password manager, what I tell people is for a month or so, just use the password you have now.
Yeah.
Just put them in the password manager and get used to hitting backslash to bring up a dialog box to enter a password. Just get used to using the program and then go through slowly and start changing.
Very, very good advice from an IT professional. Thank you, Steve. That is quite valuable. You know, as photographers, I get stuff stolen all the time. Sometimes it's like my password and my data from 500px, but in other cases, it's my images. And we've had some discussions about copyright infringement and things like that in the past. And I wouldn't quite say that this is cut and dry copyright infringement because it's transformative. I mean, we could argue that back and forth. But this next story, also from Petapixel, is titled "Award-Winning Photographer Lisa Saad Accused of Stealing Photos." And so I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her last name right. Double vowels always confuse.
Sayad, S-A-A-D.
Yeah, double vowels confuse me. Lisa is considered one of Australia's top photographers and has won numerous prestigious photo contests in both her country and internationally. But she's come under fire with serious accusations of stealing other people's photos without credit for her prize-winning images. And so there's a number of examples of this in this story. And I've seen people use other people's artwork to varying different degrees. Some of it might be questionable. Some of these lines are very, very accurately the same. But to me, it's one thing when you use somebody else's work and you do it. I encourage everybody to go check out the show notes at photogeekweekly.com and find the link to this, because you have to see these comparisons for yourself. And we might all fall on different lines of it. But what really bothers me is the bonsai tree. Did you read the article and find yeah. the dialogue about that?
You read it, and boy, did I look at those pictures.
Right. So you pick up, tell me what you think, and then we'll come back to that bonsai tree.
Okay. So let me just do the disclaimer part first. She denies it. She says she didn't do it. And in fact, to the contest that she had entered pictures at, she specifically is quoted as saying she went out and she took. And this to me is part of the evidence, actually, as to how bad this is, right? She had opportunities through questioning to credit other people. We don't know if she got licenses from some of the people that she may have.
Well, that's very true, because we can't just claim that maybe she had some non-disclosure agreement in a license that says that she could use that work and not say it. So, this delve into her work is done by photo stealers, and they found a large number of examples in which Lisa Saad apparently used other people's photos without credit, and it's unclear whether she obtained permission. So that's what we're talking about now.
And photo stealers started this because there was a Dutch photographer by the name, and I'm going to butcher the name, I'm sure, but it's Marcel van Balken, and he accused her of, I'm assuming Marcel is a guy, of taking elements from one of their award-winning photos called Runner and using it in some of her images.
It's really hard to say that this would be like stealing. It's definitely inspired by the curves.
Do you remember the Instagram case where the guy was taking Instagram actual screenshots of Instagram images and making art?
Well, of course, that was far worse. I think that this is a different type of artistry, though. You're taking somebody else's work and you're transforming it into your own. Now, I don't have a problem with that, so long as you are very thorough in what you are exactly doing. You know, talk about all of the details. Who inspired you? What is the source of your work here? Or maybe even you don't say, but say that it's derivative in some way. Say that you were inspired by something somewhere. But to say exclusively that this is solely yours with...
You went out and shot
with
them.
With mounting evidence to the contrary.
And not only that, did you see the thing about when Van Balken, Balken approached her and pressed her, show me your original then. Instead of sending the original, she shared a ping, which is, I'm guessing, a screenshot, because Max, by default, when you do a screenshot, it's a ping. He reverse searched that ping and found it was somebody else's shot. It's layer upon layer. It is.
Right. Now,
it's not
okay,
good.
So let's go down to the real fallout here. These photos should have been disqualified from the contests that were entered, because some of these images predate by many years, then thereby are excluded, but they weren't hers and are thereby excluded from her winning. And I reached out to one of my lawyers, Leslie Burns, as I like to get her opinion on some of this copyright stuff. It is again apples to oranges. It's a U.S. lawyer offering opinions on an Australian case, so it's more of just a vague opinion. She says she doesn't really know what to say, because there's so many different ways for you to go within this. For Endworks, it's not really a question of infringement. Had this been in the USA, since there's a real issue of possible fair use, and that's what I'm saying, because in fine art,
with transformative,
it's transformative. Right. And that photo stealers hasn't really proven much because there is gaps in the knowledge, right? So there's some certain bits of speculation within that.
But she also hasn't come out and properly defended
it
either.
Right. And so photo stealers, like many sites, claims that she's only voicing her opinion because it's a woman behind photo stealers as well. But she also gets very stringent about never being wrong. So you've got somebody being very strong-headed on one side, somebody being very strong-headed on the other, and they're butting heads right now.
Did you see what photo stealers found, though? To me, which this was clear. Photo stealers found a bunch of her work also with stock photography.
Okay.
Which, while not illegal, clearly violates the rules of all the contests that she's won.
So, I want to get back to that bonsai tree. So, this is sad. So there's one image that it's infringed upon from another graphic design to begin with. They changed out a bunch of the pieces, but it's still fundamentally the same framework. And they added this bonsai tree to the top of this, looking like a heart made of strong facets of architectural imagery being strung up in the air, hanging by a rope, although it's kind of floating. Anyhow, I'm doing a bad job describing it. Doesn't matter.
Was pretty good.
Okay, she describes this this tree in quotes. She says, "My mother's death felt so strongly during those nights that I grieved through my images, and this was the turning point," Saad said. "This image is dedicated to my mother," and she says in parentheses, "it is her bonsai that sits so proudly at the top." But photo stealers discovered what appears to be the original photo of the bonsai tree published by a Flickr user named Cliff under a Creative Commons license back in 2009, almost a decade away from now. And if you were to look at the two trees, yes, she has modified it slightly, but there's little holes in the structure and the foliage. Three of them very, very specifically. That's the giveaway for me.
And those don't change. And that's the thing. Like the bottom branch, she cut out, but it's clear she didn't cut out cleanly. She cut out with two little round brushes.
Yeah, it looks like a weird cloning issue.
The spikes off the trunk, she took off, but she didn't remove them. So they're just shorter. And she, softened the edges and the look of the whole thing.
But it most certainly is not her mom's bonsai tree. And to me, no.
You look at those three holes, that's the tree. I'm sorry.
It is exactly that tree. Now, the court of law, I don't think can do much in this particular case, but I think her career is over because the court of public opinion will be crucifying her for this.
Agreed. I totally agree. Yeah. And I don't know. It just, the whole thing to me, we see this more and more. We see wedding photographers building portfolios with other people's wedding and trying to claim that it's theirs. You know, you've had your images infringed. I've had my images infringed. There's a lot of great photographers out there. People, you can go out and shoot your own work. There's just no reason to do this. That's my whole thing is.
Well, did you see
the lawyer part at the end of the story?
Oh, yeah. So Lisa Saad basically sent a legal letter from a lawyer.
This is after Photo Stealers published a 7-page report of all the infringements they found.
And what did it say, Steve?
Well, the 7-page report just,
what was the legal letter?
Oh, so the lawyer sent from Saad sent a takedown notice, basically saying remove the report. They wanted Photo Stealers to apologize.
Yeah, publish an apology. Publish an apology.
They wanted Photo Stealers to make a compensation of some
that's
sort.
That's the part that really rubs me, right?
And like what did Photo Stealers do instead?
Responded by publishing even more examples of the apparent photo misuse, stating that she has never made a single fault accusation in the 5 years that Photo Stealers has been online. So again, that is the strong-headedness going against, and butting heads there,
that's
too.
That's confidence, my friend.
That is confidence. But at the same time, the evidence is really clear here that this photographer broke the rules, both in terms of ethics and representing her work, lied about the sources of content.
Allegedly.
And, allegedly, yes, I'm not a lawyer. There has not been any case, but, I'm judging based on my opinion of that bonsai tree when I can say
I know.
Lie. It's I'm my opinion. Well,
and to me, the stock photography too.
Exactly. Exactly. So when you see all of this coming together, I mean, it's clear what not to do as a professional, because in today's era of if this was done 10 years ago, it could go completely unnoticed. I mean, unless there's a very specific occasion for it. But now even artificial intelligent algorithms have gotten so good that this stuff can even be picked up by machine learning to say if somebody had entered a photo contest and stolen other people's work or vastly is influenced by it.
I agree. And if people want to see that report, it's in the Petapixel article, 7 pages.
Yeah, yeah, and I can see it. It's right near the bottom of the article, and it's got a ton of details of I don't even know how many images, but
and you want to know what's cool? It just hit me. We have photographers doing this. This is, I think, the second one in Australia that's been big news.
Well, I had one actually that I haven't even made news yet. It's a female photographer in Australia, and I'm not going to name names or anything because I haven't done anything about it. But they took one of my images and an image from a U.S. photographer based in Oregon, I think, and combined the two of them together, claimed they were their own, and even said that they had spent time taking the picture in a specific location. And yeah, so I mean, this hits close to home for me.
Right.
Not that I have anything against female photographers from Australia in general, but there is a little bit of a coincidence here. It is rampant. It is everywhere.
It's everywhere, but. You know, with all the negative that we get for the internet, we have sites like Petapixel reporting it, like Photo Stealers researching it, which, you know, to do a 7-page report on all what they think all the infringements are took time, right?
Oh, yeah.
We have people out there dedicated to also doing right. And to me, that's kind of the beauty of the whole system is no matter what's happening with the hacks and with the different camera companies coming out with different cameras at radically different prices with the same feature sets and people stealing pictures. In the end, we've got content out there that help make it all clear to us. That's part of the reason I love technology.
Well, and you know, if you want to defend your work and you're honest and you have made no mistakes, it is so easy to defend yourself. You know,
yes.
It is incredibly simplistic for you to provide people the raw files, to provide people all of the source material. And I had to do that recently in defending myself.
You did it on one of the episodes you were on my show.
Yeah. My Lady in Green, the sweat bee photograph that we talked about, which was a wonderful episode. But in the comment section, somebody had claimed that it would have been impossible for this bee to have naturally made that position. This bee had been like frozen and staged, or it was dead. I can't remember their exact words. And so
they were confident.
They were confident. And my response was to take every single photograph from that shoot, even the dark frames where the flash didn't fire because the capacitors couldn't get recharged up fast enough. Took every single one of those, put them in a zip folder on my web server and said, download every single shot. And if you want all of the raw data from every single one of these images, I'd be happy to give that to you privately as well. And I did not hear a response. So, you know, in that scenario, yeah, you can defend yourself. There's no question that if you've done no wrong, you can prove that.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
Yep. it's funny. I won't go into too many details, but there was a Petapixel article that I published recently on the demise of Outdoor Photography Canada. And somebody ripped into me on that one.
I read that.
Well, it's deleted now, so nobody can see it. And I didn't ask for it to be deleted. Petapixel deleted it. But they were basically calling me the devil for supporting the print industry. And it was the most bizarre
thing. And it was like the second, you know, first comment was, I agree with you, and then blah, blah, blah. And then out of nowhere, you are evil because you support paper.
Yeah, the pulp and paper industry. You know, of all things, you know, that outdoor photography could be harming in the world. You know, telling people to go to specific locations and then the foot traffic and vehicle traffic destroys these locations because humankind's are, we are selfish and we litter and we don't really take the proper care of things. That's just the problem with humanity. But you have a lot of these beautiful, majestic locations that are deteriorating because people are going there to take selfies and then sometimes they die because they fall off a waterfall.
down here in Southern California, we had the government shut down. So the parks were not closed, but they weren't manned. People went into Joshua Tree and cut down centuries old, you know, Joshua trees so that they could drive their trucks where they weren't supposed to go. And it's going to take hundreds of years for that stuff to recover.
Exactly. So if you're going to get up in arms about the photography industry, there's so many areas of it that you can get angry about. But anyhow, I wrote what I consider to be akin to this 7-page report. I mean, it was beautiful literature. I normally don't feed trolls, but this one I just had to make an exception to. And my only regret is that the entire thread was deleted, including my response.
Yeah, it was a good response too. It was really, it was thought out.
Yeah. Anyhow.
And what was funny was I actually was kind of hoping they'd reply. And they didn't reply to you. They replied to somebody else later maintaining the same type of attitude, right. But they didn't reply to you before the thread was
So released. There's always strong-headed people on the internet, and whether or not their opinion is correct, to defend yourself should always be a relatively easy thing when you have done no wrong. But, you know, we're always going to get accused of things whether or not we've done something wrong, and we just have to, you know, always be wary that a defensive might be necessary, because people will forever call into question your legitimacy, especially with the anonymity of the internet.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Now let's get into our picks of the week, which, you know, I think it's the first time that it has been both lenses for both people on the call.
Are you picking a lens? I can pick something different.
No. This is great. They're vastly different lenses. So, Steve, why don't you start with yours?
Okay. So as I said at the beginning of the show, this friend of mine, Adam L. Macias, great concert photographer, tours with a lot of more alt metal type bands. And also DJs, he tours with Diplo and people like that. But he has started doing music photography workshops. There's an intermediate day, there's an advanced day. The intermediate day is like level up your concert photography. The advanced day is geared towards getting people to go on, become basically transition to becoming tour photographers. And Adam is sponsored by Sigma. So he arranged at the one in New Jersey to have Sigma there with lenses for all of the attendees to the workshop to try out during the live music shoot that we do during the workshop. And I flew back there to help him. And I took a camera with me. I wasn't really planning on shooting anything but more marketing pictures for him of the students in their chairs or the students taking pictures of the live bands that he's gets or whatever. He also gets tour professionals. Like he got a really high-end tour manager and guitar techs to sit down and do Q&A with the attendees. And I'm taking pictures of that. Well, I didn't want to get too close. So I thought, all right, I've got my body with me. And all I brought was a 24-70, thinking that's all I'm going to need. I'm not shooting the band. But I went over to the people from Sigma, which were really nice. And I talked to Mark from Sigma. And I can't remember Mark's last name, although I probably have it here. I should mention his name just so that he knows. Mark Farb of Sigma was just the nicest guy. And I just looked at a really large lens on the table and went, what lens is that? And he said, oh, that's the 120-300 2.8. And I went, all right, let me try that. Part of what I wanted to know was, can I handhold this thing, right?
It's not
a light
lens. I
didn't have a monopod with me. I wanted to see how well I could do handholding. And at first glance, they were okay. In fact, they were really good. And then as you zoom in, you start to realize they were a little soft from handholding. So I bumped up my ISO and I bumped up my shutter speed, and I was shooting about 1/320th at 300 millimeters, and they were hand holding, and that lens was super nice, super sharp. Then he goes, I got a monopod if you want to use it. So I started using his monopod, which was much easier. But the lens, strangely, isn't as heavy as I thought it would be. It's beautifully tack sharp. And here's what I really loved about it. Normally, when you get a nice soft bokeh at 2.8 with a 300 lens in the background, your specular highlights have a bokeh pattern. So they might be a star shape. They might be more of a squared off octagonal shape based on your blades, the number of blades that you have in the aperture and the shape of those blades. Well, these blades are apparently rounded intentionally to soften that so you don't really get so much of a pattern. You get this really just nice overall soft background. It was beautiful. It was really beautiful. So I looked at him thinking, all right, well, I can't afford this lens. This is going to be expensive. How much is it? It retails at $3,600. Right now it's on sale at B&H or at Sigma for $3,400, $3,399 US.
If this is your bread and butter kind of thing to be doing, then that is not an unapproachable number.
No, and you're going to spend on a 300 2.8 Canon, what is that, $6,000?
Something like that.
You can get it used, you know, or refurbed for probably 35. But this, what I loved about it was it's not a 300. It's a 120 to 300.
And for the kind of work that you do, concert photography, for example, one focal length does not work for an entire day of shooting.
I know people who shoot with primes, but if I'm shooting from front of house soundboard, 300 is great. If, however, I've got run of the house and I can shoot from the pit where I can now with one lens do a 120, or I could do a really tight shot of a drummer with 300, or I could be at the front of house in the middle of an arena where the soundboard is, and I could get in tight on somebody, but I could also get the entire front of the stage. This range, as I was shooting at this event, was just such a, it's like how I feel about the 24 to 105 in the Canon
world. Right, but we're a stop faster, right? So it's much more flexible.
And that's the thing. The 24 to 105 to me is just this amazing range for walk around or for concerts at times. But the 120 to 300 being 2.8 all the way through, and it was sharp at 300. I can't say enough about this lens. I don't own it, but I'm thinking about it. But I will tell you, I used it for that day and I fell in love with it.
Very good to hear. I haven't used that lens myself, but on paper, it seems incredibly flexible, especially because of that F2.0 aperture. That is, to me, the deciding factor why it would be used over other lenses in that particular kind of venue. Now,
well, and think about this for somebody who shoots, you know, wildlife or birds. So you got 2.8 throughout. And you've got a range to really do what you need instead of walking out there with a 400 or a 300. It just, and it's 3,600 retail.
Yeah.
It was, and it's solid.
I remember looking at, was it the Canon 200 to 400 that has the built-in teleconverter? And I mean, you just about have to add a zero to that. I mean, not quite, but it was like $12,000 or something in that neighborhood. So these lenses can get out of control price-wise very, very quickly. And that's why I say, you know, $3,600 to $3,400, depending on if you can get it on sale or get one used to. That's, you know, something to look at if that's your wheelhouse, if that is what's going to make or break your photo shoot, because it will pay for itself over the lifetime of its usage.
Very quickly. And you use a lot of different lenses. I've always stayed within the Canon range because a lot of the third parties for years, it was always, oh, you got a good copy, bad copy type thing. That's not, since at least for Sigma, since they came out with the Art Series lenses, they have really stepped up their game. And Sigma lenses are, they're 14 millimeter, I tried too, by the way. And it was, wow, awesome.
Well, and I'm shooting with Canon lenses for many years. One of the lenses that I will not let go of when I sell all of my Canon gear is my pick of the week. And I don't think I picked it before, and I'm surprised that I didn't. Maybe I did, but it's worth mentioning it again because I'm using it every single day right now. And that is the Canon MPE 65mm f2.8 macro lens. Now, its claim to fame is that it starts, like the furthest it can focus away is 4 inches from the front element. So from there to...
Wait, did you say furthest, not closest?
The furthest it can focus away. It does not have infinity focus. The furthest away it can focus is 4 inches.
Wow.
And it goes closer from there. And that's at the 1:1 magnification. That's where this lens starts. It picks up where the average macro lens stops. And then it just goes farther. This lens, actually, I've got it here. Not that anybody can see it, but it just as a visual aid for Steve.
Oh, my God.
This is the fully extended lens from this point to this point. It does not have a focus ring or a zoom ring. It has a magnification ring. And now I use it with extension tubes and extra optics and things like that to push the magnification even farther, but it gets up to 5:1 magnification within the same lens. So if you want to get into extreme macro and you want to get 5 times closer than the average macro lens, which gets 1:1 magnification, then this is the lens that I have been using to do all of my snowflake and extreme macro work, or at least 99.9% of it. I've experimented with other things, but I've always came back to this lens.
Could you shoot snowflakes with just that without the extension tubes?
Absolutely. It depends on the size of them. Snowflakes can measure in size to be like a third of a millimeter. And so that won't fill the frame at 5:1 if your sensor is 36 millimeters across. So more pixels is always better. I add a set of extension tubes, which will put it just like a set from Kenko or whoever. We'll go from 5:1 up to 6:1, so a little bit closer. And that's 6 times magnification. But then I can also add into the mix, it's not on here right now, but the Canon Life-Size Converter EF, which is was designed for the quite antiquated Canon 50mm f2.5 compact macro that only ever got to 1:2 magnification. That's half life-size. But you could add some extra optics that would double the magnification. In all the literature on that piece, Canon basically said it can't be used with any other lens, but there's no reason why I can't try. And it doubled the magnification on this. So I can go all the way up to 12:1 magnification.
How often do you use that?
Well, for snowflakes, quite often, actually. Okay. When I get a storm that's making tiny little hexagonal snowflakes, that's it, that's exactly what I'll be using. So, yeah, the optics do degrade the image quality a little bit, but you are getting more in terms of resolution as a result at the end of the day. But the
what does that run?
The lens itself, the MPE 65mm lens, is $1,049 right now on B&H. And they've got them used for $838. Now, the reason why I mention that is because this lens is a really, really hard lens to use. You can't focus by normal means. It has no focusing ring. It has no autofocus. You have to physically focus by moving your camera forward and backward in order to shift your focus. You can do this on a focusing rail, or you can do this handheld like I do. But regardless of how you do it, you have to play by a different rule book to get things in focus. And that's really frustrating for a lot of people. If you don't have an external light source, I use ring flashes a lot of the time for this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you had a ring flash that looked like it was actually attached to the filter thread.
Yes. Yeah. So that one that I was using on this one is the KNF Concept KF-150. Which the one that I have here is designed for Nikon cameras, but I use it in manual mode on Panasonic bodies just fine. So
is that what it is? Is it screwed on? How does that attach?
There's a filter. It's not a filter. It looks kind of like a bizarre step up ring filter, but it doesn't have filter threads on it. It's just a bare edge on the outside that the ring flash clamps onto. And so you can do that with any lens, not this one in particular. It's just a screw on piece. Although if you are a Canon shooter and you have this lens and you want to use the Canon ring flash, you don't need any extra accessories. It just clamps on directly. But the reason why I mentioned the used ones is because it's such a frustrating lens to use. I'm going to bet you that at least 70% of the used market for this lens have been used once and put back in the box. So if
they got it and went, wait, there's no, wait, I can't focus it?
Yeah, I can't focus it. I'm just, this is too frustrating. I don't have a light source. All of my images are blurry. I can't get anything sharp. It's garbage. Let's send it back. And then it gets listed as a used item eventually, or it gets traded in by people that bought it from different retailers. So that, I can't guarantee you that the used inventory from B&H is as such. But I have seen so many of these lenses in mint condition going for less than retail because they were just too difficult to use.
What was the number on that?
The MPE 65mm. So MP-E.
Gotcha.
And it's if you want to do extreme macro, there is no better lens on the market to do this type of stuff, especially with the level of flexibility that it has to go from 1:1 all the way to 5 and even further with the extra accoutrements you can add on.
And they've got two of them used right now. And one of the things I love actually about used lenses from B&H is that they rank them. So they've got an item condition 9.
And one 8+, which you can be pretty much guaranteed the optics on either of them are flawless. And there's not really a whole lot of electronics that can go awry here. It does have electronic communication for, setting the aperture blades, but there's no focusing motor. There's nothing else. It's a fairly simple lens and it's a fairly robust one too. So that is my pick. And if anybody has any questions about that or wants to discuss extreme macro photography at length, always send me an email because that's the kind of stuff that I love to wake up and write about in the morning with my coffee. All right, Steve, where can people find you online? And what's the latest episode of your podcast, Behind the Shot?
People can find me online on Instagram or Twitter. It's just my first name and last name. So at Steve Brazel, it's like the country Brazil, but two L's. On Facebook, it's Steve Brazel Photography. And the podcast is at behindtheshot.tv. And the latest episode is the second episode I've done in conjunction with Red River Paper, which you and I talked about on an episode before, Red River Paper has an educational program where they supply paper to photography schools around the U.S. And one of the schools that they do this, each quarter I'm getting either an instructor or a student on just as a normal guest to try and really see where the state of photography education is. So I'm bringing a student on with one of their pictures and we dissect the picture just like I do any other guest. And I just released an episode yesterday. It's the second one with a young lady, Lois Einhardt. And Lois is a student at FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, a storied, you know, respected photography education program. And she's got this, I'm not going to lie, okay? You know me well enough to know my facial expressions and people can't see them here. This is one of the only episodes where, as she described how she made the picture, right? I looked at this going, it's good Photoshop work. She did some really neat stuff in Photoshop with some brushes. Okay, I get it all. Completely wrong, 100% wrong how I thought she made this image. In the episode, there's a point where I'm like a cartoon where I put my hands up to my face going, ah. I had no, the way she described she made this image in camera was so refreshing. This woman went outside the box to make her shot, right? And it was wonderful to hear. And along with each of these education episodes, we're giving away Red River Paper sample packs. All the rules for that are up on the website as well.
That's awesome. And behindtheshot.tv. I've been on two episodes and maybe another one in the future.
I need to get you on again. I want to do one of your landscape shots or maybe one of your fluorescent shots.
So many choices.
I don't know.
I'd be happy to be on multiple times over the years. Not too much all at once. I don't want to pollute the stream and make it too centric around my work. But I am very happy to have those conversations with you, Steve. And thanks for having me on.
Well, and that's one of the things that I like about it. And you and I have had this conversation before, but I really want the podcast to hit all genres of photography and jump around. So the next episode I've got is a street photography episode coming up. And the episode before this one was a wonderful portrait of Jeff Bridges, the actor, by a guy by the name of Ian Spanier, who's a wonderful, he's going to be at Santa Fe Photo Workshops. But I like it to kind of hit a little of everything. I had Moose Peterson on, who does wildlife.
And I love getting inside the head.
So I kind of like to vary.
Yeah, I like getting inside the head of street photographers because they all have such vastly different approaches to make magic in camera. So I'm going to look forward to listening to that one as well.
Yeah, it's the one coming up at the end of the month. I've already got it in the can. Is a street photographer out of Germany that also runs a podcast network, the PPN network, Marco LaRousse. And a great episode. So, and then I've got some totally new stuff. I've got a totally new one, somebody that works for Canon, actually, coming up in March.
Very cool. Looking forward to all of that, Steve. That's at behindtheshot.tv for his podcast, for the show notes, and all of the past episodes of this podcast. You can find the details at Photo.
I want to give a plug for you before you say goodbye.
Okay, well, I was just going to say photogeekweekly.com. Go there for this podcast, but Steve, please plug me.
So, Photo Geek Weekly, but okay, so here's the deal. I've been wanting to say this, and I say it on my thing, but you have more followers than me, so I've got to do this. I follow you on Twitter for your snowflake a day thing, and I don't shoot snowflakes. I don't foresee in Southern California I will be shooting snowflakes anytime soon. But I kid you not, as that stream comes through every day, if I've got 500 tweets that I haven't read, I will scroll every tweet. And if there is a tweet of one of your snowflakes, because what's really cool is you do the snowflake, but you also give a small, almost scientific description of why the snowflake looks like it looks, right?
Oh, Steve, if you were to read the full text on Facebook or Flickr or, well, for now, Google Plus and 500px, but on any of those places, I write more than a written page's worth of text associating to all of that stuff. But I just don't have enough space on Twitter.
And that's my point. And I do see it on all those things. But Twitter's a good way to just kind of go through and you want to get introduced to Don's work, you go through and it's this little thing and then you this little bit of text and then you see that thing. And it is literally, I'm saying this very seriously to you, Don. I get so much inspiration out of those snowflake shots every single day.
Well, thank you.
That it is just amazing. So if you are not following Don on his social media and checking out his snowflake a day, you need to do that.
You can find all of the links to that at doncom.ca, D-O-N-K-O-M.ca. Doncom, by the way, is also my Twitter handle if you want the shortcut to get there and keep track of it. And thank you for that, Steve. I appreciate the plug. I mean, I don't want to toot my own horn or anything, but it makes me really happy when people are enthusiastic about me.
I run to my wife with this picture. Not even kidding.
Fantastic.
Honey, look at this one. I'm not even kidding.
All right. Well, with all of that said, I think that it is time to get out and shoot.